The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics Podcast for October 27th, 2021. It's your old boy, Justin Robert Young, joining you again from Austin, Texas. But really, my heart, my mind, the call is from DC. Indeed, the Mid-Atlantic region is going to dominate this podcast. Not only are we going to talk about the ever-tightening race in Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, Glenn Youngkin. I gotta say, look, I'm not willing to put my name on it just yet. I'm not willing to put my name on it just yet, but I have to say that I'm not liking what I'm seeing out of the actions from the Terry McAuliffe campaign. They do not seem to me to be confident moves. They seem to be reactionary moves, and you never want to see that, as we are now less than a week away from Election Day. We will also hear the latest on the Build Back Better agreement, vote, arguments. We don't know. We legitimately have no idea. We are close, allegedly. Nancy Pelosi says we are close, but we don't know for sure. And we will be joined by your friend, my friend, the world's friend, Andrew Heaton, who is going to spend a little time with us as well. But first, look, I don't know for sure if Terry McAuliffe is in trouble. I don't. But here's what I do know. I do know that he is acting like somebody that's in trouble. And that's not good. That's not good for him. Now, this is, all right, into my mind, the way that I think about campaigns, right? I tend to think about campaigns the way I think about sailboats. So let's say you're building a sailboat. Building a sailboat's an expensive thing, you know, or a cheaper thing if you want a DIY, right? You know, you got just a thing that floats and a sail. You can do it a bunch of different ways. But you got to build and construct this structure. You got to staff it as best you can. And then you got to point your sails in the direction that you need to go. And you hope that the wind of the people is with you. What you don't want to see in any kind of sailing situation is for you to have to drastically change where your sails are. Because if you're doing that, it means that you're not getting the wind at your back that you need in the direction that you thought you were going to go. And with that, you never want to see a campaign that you assume is winning, changing its topic in the final week of campaigning. And let's double down on that fretting. It's even worse when you are pivoting to an issue that your opponent has made a meal out of. And that is why I'm worried about Terry McAuliffe talking more and more about education. So here's what Terry's saying now. His opponent, Republican Glenn Youngkin, is going to gut teacher positions and possibly close schools with his budget. He wants you to know that this is a much bigger threat to how your kids get their education in the state of Virginia than anything to do with critical race theory or supposed strong or school board strongmen. This is because Glenn Youngkin, up till this point, has been killing McAuliffe when it comes to schools. I'm going to read you a crosstab from a recent Suffolk poll, a poll that showed Youngkin and McAuliffe essentially tied. Here's the question. Should parents or school boards have more of an influence on their school's curriculum? Out of all respondents, 50% said parents, 39% said school boards. Let's dive even deeper. Democrats, it was 16% parents, 70% school boards. Republicans said 79% parents and 12% school boards. This is a winning issue when it comes to Republicans, and a winning issue when it comes to everybody. 50 to 39%. That's a winning issue. That is a, you know, barely above water, but just sitting there at 50%. That means that the candidate that beats up on school boards is going to do well. And we told you about this. We told you about the school boards. We told you about the Loudoun County debacle that happened on the podcast last week. And this has only intensified it. That poll that I just read, it's not an outlier. There have been four polls that have come out over the last week and a half. Three ties and one with McAuliffe up one. This looks tight, 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 tight. And for the first time, when you're seeing McAuliffe talking about education, it makes the Dems look nervous. I mean, hell, you want to see nervous? Check out this quote from the New York Times in the story that came out on Tuesday. It's a nervous as hell donor sweating through his tracksuit. Quote, the party is single-handedly torpedoing Terry McAuliffe, said a trial lawyer in Florida who donates a lot to the party nationally and to McAuliffe in Virginia. And I think that if Terry loses, Democrats need to grab a hold of themselves because the midterms are going to be a bloodbath. Ah. If that sounds familiar to you, the idea that a donor would be very mad at the party not supporting his support of Terry McAuliffe, that's because both McAuliffe's campaign and commentators have been blaming Biden and the Democrats for the past month. If this is close, if Terry loses, blame the president. Blame the progressives in Congress for not supporting Biden. Blame Joe Manchin for not giving in. This was supposed to be easy. Biden was the competent government guy. He now has both houses of Congress and the White House. He's supposed to get stuff through. But even if by the time you hear this, there is a signed Build Back Better bill and everyone's happy about it. Joe Manchin and Bernie Sanders both do a simultaneous backflip. Kyrsten Sinema and AOC just are pounding shots together. Like let's say that happens. I don't know if it matters in Virginia in the way that a lot of people think it might, because all politics are local. Aside from the residents of Northern Virginia who literally work in federal government, the average Virginia voter cares more about local school board trends than any kind of social safety net bill that'll take a year to unfurl. Now, in 3 years, will Virginia voters be single issue zealots about something that's in that bill? Maybe. But now? An election that takes place a week from now, rather? I don't think so, Fred. All right, I'm going to end on this. I know that many of you did not love my interview with Brian Sack a few months ago. If you don't remember the name, he is the normally very, very funny comedian who was deadly serious and downright spitting mad when it came to the fact that his son's school, in his mind, was taken over and made worse, far worse, by a racist intervention from a diversity counselor. You don't have to like that point. I mean, hell, even though I like Brian, you don't have to like Brian Sack. But if part of the point of you listening to this podcast is understanding the tactics of politics, understanding the reality of what it takes to get elected, understanding the people that you need to get into a booth to hit your button more than they hit the button of the other guy, then you do need to understand his anger. You have to understand that parents are single issue voters when it comes to their kids. And if the majority of Virginia parents don't have faith in school boards, then this is Youngkin's ticket to a win the more he beats up on it. And McAuliffe better hope that being able to pivot to say, yeah, but also he's going to take away the ability for your kids to learn at all, is a winning way to mitigate his losses. Oh, geez. I hate doing these segments sometimes. I hate doing these segments when news is still breaking and things are going on. But here we are. This is the latest at the point that I'm recording this, which is about midday on Tuesday with the Build Back Better framework. Nancy Pelosi met with House Democrats to say that an agreement on Build Back Better would come up sometime either today or tomorrow. This will allegedly include a billionaire's tax instead of a rate hike. That was one of the cinema demands. What the billionaire's tax will look like, it will likely include some kind of a wealth tax. So that means that you will be taxed on unrealized gains up to and including stocks and artwork. If you are past a certain level. Now, some of the opponents of that bill are saying that it might not be constitutional. It's not a traditional tax hike. And also, when you're specifically going after billionaires with a new law, billionaires have a very, very, very nasty habit of figuring out ways that they can avoid that law. But still, that is the path that they are on right now. Here's what we don't know. We don't know what kind of climate change is in there. We assume that there will be no immigration stuff in there. And we have very little idea on either the scope of some of the social safety net stuff that'll be in there, up to and including closing the Medicare gap, hearing, dental, and vision. Blah, blah, blah. We have no idea, nor do we have any idea what time frame will be on some of these packages. Now, Democrats do seem very bullish that there will be an agreement. And Biden wants a vote on the infrastructure bill ASAP as soon as an agreement from Manchin and Sinema and the rest of the Senate Democrats have one with the House that basically says, cool, we're going to pass this bill, no amendments. It gets passed both houses, bada bing, bang, boom. Meanwhile, in Congress and specifically in the House, you've got the Progressive Caucus leader, Pramila Jayapal, saying, well, I mean, if we're already close to the actual bill, then maybe we don't vote immediately. on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Maybe we don't. Maybe we just wait. You know, if we're that close to it, why don't we just wait? We would prefer, as we have always said, being the progressives, that we're going to pass the BBB and then we'll pass the BIF. Then we'll pass the bipartisan infrastructure. So here's the reality. The reality is that Biden wants something in hand because as of today, as of Wednesday, he's off. He's in Rome and then he's in Glasgow. He's got two massive UN climate change meetings wherein he has to project a leadership role in terms of reducing greenhouse gases. According to Punchbowl, the White House has already shifted their talking points away from the climate change provisions that were supposed to be in the BBB and toward the bipartisan infrastructure bill's green infrastructure investments. That gives you a sense of how confident they are that they will have one and not the other. I told this to everybody listening on the Sunday show. I will repeat it for you here. The people to watch are the progressives. Bernie, Jayapal, AOC. Are they going to blanch at the fact that Manchin won? He won. Bernie wanted 6. Bernie compromised the 3.5. Manchin said 0. Okay, fine. 1.5 trillion. And guess where they're going to land at? 1.5 trillion. That's where they're going to land at. Will the progressives say we're not going to take half a loaf on this? Because to be totally honest, if you were to rewind all this stuff way, way, way back when the progressives put the brakes on voting for the bipartisan infrastructure package, and you were to ask them, hey, what do you think would happen if you pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill? They'd probably say something like, well, I think the BBB would pass, but it would not have blah, 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 blah. And I think all the blah, 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 blah is literally the stuff that got cut out. It's the stuff that got cut out. It's not there. So that's what you got to look for. You got to look for, like, are the progressives willing to fight one more time on this? Because we are coming to a time for choosing. There already was one and they held firm, but they didn't really get much for their effort. Will they do it again? That's the question. Ladies and gentlemen, you always know the way to support this show, and that is by heading on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Again, TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Heading out of here, out of the Lone Star State, on my way to Old Virginia. That's where we're going to see the end of this Youngkin-McAuliffe clash. You know, by the way, just DM'd with our friend Evan Scrimshaw, our lines guy, our political betting guy. He has been watching this Virginia race very, very, very closely. I just DM'd him. I slid in his DMs and I said, still McAuliffe minus 8? So McAuliffe will win by 8 points? And he said, yes. Those polls are trash. He does not believe that this is a tied race. He believes that this is still a big, wide open contest and McAuliffe is cruising. So does that mean that McAuliffe is maybe panicking a little bit? Does it mean that McAuliffe is a little unsure? Maybe he's buying into the hype. Maybe he and his staff is buying in to these polls. We don't know. But Scrimshaw thinks that it's still a done deal. And I tend to think that it's going to be very hard for McAuliffe to win. But anyway, if you want all the coverage of this race, specifically the Extra Sunday show that will not only cover all of the Sunday programming, but also anything that I go out and cover on the trail on Sunday. Well, you got to go over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com right now. $3 pledge per week gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week. I'm telling you, it's a good time to get on the trade right now. I don't know why I'm Seinfeld. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Our guest today is just a sweet, sweet man. He's a very smart human being. He's a hilarious person. He's a dapper dresser. And you want to know what, friends? He's just a good soul. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Heaton joins us yet again. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Andrew Heaton.
A pleasure to be here. Hello, Justin.
Now, not only are you among my favorite people to talk politics with in general, but
thank you.
You also happen to have a career before this as a sterling political pundit, as somebody who worked in Congress. So when I contacted you to come on, what popped into my mind is, as we are now, I mean, like, look, this is one of those episodes where I've already recorded the segment about what's happening with Congress. Uh-huh. It's changed 3 times since I started editing and scheduling like interviews and stuff like that. So I might have to re-record it. A lot's changing. A lot's happening. We are in the 11th hour of the 11th hour of the once delayed 11th hour. You having been there have a little bit more of a sense of how things feel, what's happening right now as party line votes are going to be very, very thin. You can't have anybody falling out. Yeah. So give me a sense. Give the audience a sense of what this feels like.
So remember that I intuitively glom on to people that are in the middle of the battlefield and will be struck down by partisan bullets.
Yes.
That was very much
favorite.
I was doing. That's my favorite. Is I go, who's the Lib Dem equivalent in this situation? Who's the person that's gonna get absolutely smacked? So I've not been on the side of this of we've got a ton of pressure because we've got to get this omnibus bill passed or Congress shuts down. I think that happened when I was on the Hill, but there wasn't really a significant threat of that occurring. It had occurred the year prior to me being there.
Yeah.
Which was super fun for the Republicans because the Republicans would bring in the lights are all off and they take tour groups into the house proper and show them how the lights were off and they can make it a big deal. And then it happened again.
This is a big government shutdown situation where.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Back when they weren't like just kind of a the equivalent of Arbor Day where you could predict it.
Yeah.
Like now that's a thing. Yeah. Now just every year the government's going to shut down for some amount of time. It was actually big back in the day when it first was happening. Like it used to happen once every 8 years. Now it happens every year.
I mean, geez, it unsettled Bill Clinton so much. He started banging Monica, or quote unquote banging. I don't want to dig up that, but.
Mm-hmm. Poor guy. Well, you know, I'm glad she could be there for him to make that work. So I'll say like what the high pressure moments that I recall, and I should preface this. I was on the constituent side of this. I would have loved to have worked in policy.
Yeah.
I didn't work on the Hill long enough to work in policy. So I wasn't the one making decisions on this or briefing the congressman. I was getting screamed at by constituents.
Gotcha.
That was my job. And in that capacity, I was still advising the congressman because I was there during the Obamacare vote on the ACA.
Which
was contentious.
Yeah,
Justin.
A little bit. People don't remember. Uh-huh. I mean, how much of a fight that was. That was a knockdown, drag out fight. So remind everybody where
I
this
absolutely
district
heard
is.
From. Every single person's parent that's currently listening to this program. If you have a parent over 55 that has any tendency to yell at people, I absolutely spoke to them on the phone at some point, despite the fact they were not from, I believe it's the 17th district of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Which is Harrisburg up through Pottsville is where I was working for.
City of Lights.
City of Lights. Great place. Beautiful part of the country.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
I was working for them. And that was super high pressure, both in terms of the politique of the member and just in terms of me having to get screamed at all the time.
Yeah.
So Tim was, he's now, I want to say he runs the Soviet Liquor Board of Pennsylvania or something. I think that's where he wound up. But back in the day when he was still a member of Congress before he got primaried, he was a Blue Dog Democrat, which I know I've spoken about on the program before, yep. but Blue Dog Democrats were moderate to conservative Democrats, however you want to define that. And they came in many shapes and forms.
Yeah.
Tim was now
like the only person for whom would even remotely resemble that is Joe Manchin. I mean, Joe Manchin. And then
I'd say Kristen Sinema, maybe.
She's her own brand of
Lord. Well, I like to tip that. I wouldn't have said this back in the day, but now that I've been gone for a while, Blue Dog conservative could mean fiscally responsible Democrat, or it could mean Democrat that was slightly uncomfortable around Black people. Like it could be a socially conservative Democrat, or it could be a fiscally conservative Democrat.
And back in the day, that second one was all the Democrats. You know, at least the Democrats.
Yeah, we go far enough back. Yeah,
yeah. Before
my time,
Dixon for sure.
But Tim was in that category of he was in favor of having a balanced budget or at least having federal spending caps. He was concerned with the maintenance of federal spending in something tethered to math and a finite supply of resources, and hats off to him in that regard. At the same time, he was a really big trade guy. He was a protectionist. So he had nuanced opinions across the board. And he was definitely relying on us to get a feel for how the district was going on that. He did not reveal how he was going to vote, I think, until the day of. He played his cards very close to his chest. I suspect in retrospect that Tim was doing that in order to leverage his position as best he could so that Nancy Pelosi didn't know how he was going to vote. So he'd go, I don't know. I can't really get behind it. But if you did this one thing, he ended up voting no on it and probably got primaried as a result of it. That probably cost him the election subsequently against another Democrat who then in turn lost to another Republican. So well done, everybody, for that one. But I spoke to a ton of people, and he was actively wanting to hear from constituents on that one. Like normally I'd say most members of Congress aren't really divided on the basic issues that are pertinent to their district. If you're from a corn growing district, your congressman doesn't want to hear from you on corn subsidies.
Yeah.
He's going to give you corn subsidies. But there are certain issues that are like that. In our case, we were relying on faxes, which are horrible and just useless. And then to a great extent, just, you know, what are people saying when they call you, and are they from the district? Because again, I heard from a ton of angry, retired, unemployed people that called every member of Congress every single day, despite the fact that we don't care what you think because you don't live in our district and you don't understand how democracy works.
So the
anger comes out. I
want to channel it. So bring me back. You're on the phone. What is the Andrew Heaton phone tree to determine that somebody is or is not from that congressional district in Pennsylvania?
I had a whole thing. And I'll say this, and it pains me to say this because I am a beloved native scion of Oklahoma.
Yeah.
But the callers from Oklahoma were much worse than the callers in Pennsylvania. I don't know why. I don't know why it was, but because I started out working for Dan Boren, who is a Blue Dog Democrat from Eastern Oklahoma, and some of the meanest, most vitriolic things I've ever heard in my life came from constituents that were calling at that time, and they were usually Republicans.
Give me the worst. I'll bleep it if we have to.
Yeah, sure. Hold on. You ready for this?
Yeah. All right. He's standing up now.
You're ruining our business. I hate you. God damn you. I hope you die. Fuck you. Fuck Nancy Pelosi. You should all go to hell, you traitors. You traitorous fucking bastards.
He's red-faced. He stood up. He took 5 steps beyond the mic, and he is now red-faced screaming, "Brava! What a performance for Andrew Heaton as angry Oklahoman calling to scream at a hapless aide."
There was one specific guy who would do that. I would usually have to like excuse myself and take a walk around Cannon House to calm myself down. I can't fathom that man is still alive based on his blood pressure.
Uh-huh.
But calls like that. So the ones like even though those are impolite, you call your congressman. Like I'd say unless you're making a death threat or you're dropping F-bombs and things at that point. The staff doesn't have to listen to you if you're going to be swearing at them and things like that. But if you've got a hot and passionate opinion, go for it. excuse me. Catch my breath.
He's still recovering. Well, I would imagine that the man.
What I started doing when I worked for the Pennsylvania office to preempt that.
Yeah.
Is I would try and communicate one. I'm a human being. So I'd pick up and go, "Hi, this is Andrew. Who am I speaking to?" That way I'd get their name.
Yeah.
And then pretty quick, I'd talk to them, you know, and where are you calling from? And if they were calling from Pennsylvania, we would take the call just because, you know, to kind of be neighborly. But I would say, like, you know, we're not actually, if you're in Pittsburgh, we're not actually your congressman. Do you want me to direct you to your congressman? And if they were calling from like Montana or something, if there weren't other calls, I might talk to them for a minute. But a lot of the time, like during the ACA vote, be like, look, like our job here and the job of the congressman is to hear from his district.
From constituents,
so I need to let you go so that we can hear from our constituents.
So you didn't hit him with a, due to a high call volume, we are no longer taking random phone calls.
I'd say I was not nearly so flippant or glib as I could have been. But this is also like 24-year-old, like very
fresh
excited
face,
to work on the Hill.
Heaton. Andrew Heaton.
Right. This is, you know, I still looked 47, but I inside I felt much younger. And then I took my responsibilities very, very seriously and was also very careful. Like when people would call and like, how can you possibly, what do you think about this? I'd go, you know, I am not here representing myself. Like if I'm ever in Pennsylvania and you happen to see me, I would love to get a drink with you and tell you what I think.
Yeah.
But here in this official capacity, I'm representing the district and I'm representing the member. And it's really only your opinion and the congressman's opinion who counts in this equation. I'm just a conduit between the two of you.
I would imagine that even the person who's screaming and cursing at you, I don't know how you recorded everything, be it paper or a spreadsheet, but at least that's a quick and easy mad. Like this person angry at this thing or very much for this thing. Thank you very much. You have been duly noted. Here's what I do want to move on to. How does that get back to the congressman? Like, are you typing up a report? Do you bring it to them and say, well, we got seven fours, nine against, and somebody asked me for my phone number?
I'd say usually it's anecdotal. So if it's a situation where for some reason we got 10 calls about this particular issue, maybe we'd bring it up. But there too, I have to say it's so difficult to actually figure out who cares.
Yeah.
So for one thing, like I hope they're not using faxes anymore, or if they are, I hope that they all have got some kind of automated email program that just sorts it for them.
Sure.
When I was there, that was technology which was existent, but not technology we were utilizing. So we literally had a fax machine and people fax bomb. So in my experience, angry people that want to yell at their congressman also want to yell at every other congressman and see no problem with sending a free fax to all 453 members. So for that reason, faxes were very unreliable. And unless a constituent actually put in their address, in which case we would send them a response letter. But if they didn't do that, it was like, well, the chances, there's about a 1 out of 453 chance this person's actually in our district. Ditto with emails, which were less reliant at the time, although I think now most members have like a dedicated message page. So instead of emailing, you know, joe.lieberman@senate.gov or whatever, you go to their website. So I imagine that probably works better because you've got to put in your zip code.
There's controls you can have for a web form, but
I suspect that they've got better on that. It depended on the issue and it depended on how contentious it was and how intent the congressman was on getting metrics for it. I'll say the other thing too, like even with phone calls, there's what's called phone banking. So there'll be some lobbying outfit that wants to, they're really up in arms about the Ledbetter Act. I don't even remember what the Ledbetter Act was, but it was a thing back when I was on the Hill. And so, and it was horrible when you got phone banked because what they would do is they would just call every constituent in your district and say, Congressman Holden's thinking about cutting Medicare and Social Security. Do you have thoughts on this? And like, weirdly enough, all old people have thoughts on that. And they go, would you like to talk to your congressman? And they go, yeah. And then I'd pick up. So from my perspective, somebody dialed a number to get me, but that didn't happen. They just got connected to one of these outfits. And for that reason,
would just three-way call you while they had this person on the phone.
Yeah. Yeah. And then for a lot of people, like, because I never heard the phone call, but I assume it was probably even automated because people I'd pick up and go, hi, this is Andrew. Who am I speaking to? And they'd go, "Why did you call me?" And I'd go, "Well, I didn't, sir. I picked from my perspective.
Wow.
I just picked up the phone." And they go, "Well, it said that you're thinking about cutting Social Security." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know, you know, who told you that." So for that, even phone calls for that reason weren't really great indicators. Now, we did have good data that if somebody took the time to call you, it meant that they were, I think, 5 times more likely to vote.
Yeah.
So it was a thing where we took it seriously. In my experience, pretty much every politician I know, and I've met quite a few at this point in my life, politicians generally have a kind of pie chart approach towards how they're making decisions. So let's say 50% of the pie chart is locked in when they get elected.
Yeah.
I'm pro-life or I'm pro-choice. This is not something I'm going to waver on. I'm pro-union, whatever that thing is. This is part of the deal when you elected me. And then a quarter of it is stuff that they're leaning towards, but if their district really feels strongly about it, they'll upend their position and say, you know, this is not something that's fundamental to my political orientation. I'm willing to represent the opinion of the district. And then about a quarter of the stuff they don't care about. And I don't mean that in a glib, flippant way. It's just something that's not occurred to them previously. And they are relying on constituents to inform them of, you know, I had no thoughts on federal fire truck insurance subsidies, but apparently that's a big deal in Pottsville or whatever. And so the congressman was generally only trying to get information from us when it was either a really contentious vote,
yeah,
because he was in a swing district as a blue dog, as with like cap and trade or ACA, or it was an issue where he really didn't have a specific preordained opinion on governance and so wanted to hear from his district.
One of the things that's happening right now are targeted advertising from groups, lobbying groups, that will target a congressperson. Specifically, we've seen it a lot now on both the Reconciliation Act and the build and the bipartisan infrastructure stuff. That is not an attack ad, but it's like everything but an attack ad. It is like, mm-hmm, Josh Gottheimer said he'll never cave to Nancy Pelosi unless he gets blah, blah, blah. Like, well, it looks like he's about to cave. Tell him not to cave. Call this, mm-hmm, right now. Were you on the on the business end of that, or was it mostly just the phone banks and stuff like that?
I don't remember there being any attack ads, but then again, I wasn't there during a campaign year.
Sure. A campaign. This is literally right, just to pressure, yeah, this vote here right now. So I guess my larger question is, I don't know if that was in favor or if maybe the phone banks were more effective at the time. And now they've, you know, for whatever different spam call laws, they have moved on to another less targeted version.
Television influenced callers, but I don't remember there being an association with specific issue advertisements that led to that. What I noticed was that we would get a deluge of angry conservative calls more or less 5 minutes after Glenn Beck or one of the other conservative pundits' program concluded. Like
gotcha.
You could almost set your clock by it. Of we were going to get phone calls after specific Fox programming. So that would elicit.
So, all right.
Things,
so I guess like 3:05 after Rush is done. And then,
yes,
you know, like 6:05 when Glenn is done, when he was still on Fox.
Yeah. Or Sean Hannity, I think, would probably have been one of the other big ones back in the day. Yes. Yeah. So we would definitely hear from those folks, but I don't remember there being specific advertisements that would elicit it. Although I don't know that I would have heard them. Like, it's possible that a constituent would have said, you know, I just saw this advertisement that, but a lot of the time they just kind of jump into it. I'd say the stuff that was kind of frightening, Justin.
Yeah.
Like this is, if anybody listened to the program, like I'm going to back up.
Go.
You know, back during when the Capitol Hill riots happened.
Yeah.
Actually, prior to the Capitol Hill riots, I was very, you know, like, Trump is refusing to concede the election. This,
yeah,
is a really big deal. This is not good. Like, there was no wavering on my part. And I had some people that were like, man, Heaton's kind of an elitist insider. And listen, talk to a couple thousand mouth-breathing idiots over the phone as a constituent liaison, and it will rapidly suck out your appreciation for populism. Like I've been through the gauntlet here. Like, I once had a woman call me and say, we've got too many Mexicans. We should add them to hunting season. That was one of her. That's what she
charming,
thought would be a good
charming
way to deal with it. Now, granted, I think she was being sardonic. But then I'd have other people that would like call and go, you know, I just read this email that was forwarded by Gene Hackman, And Gene Hackman said he was on a plane where Muslims were watching pornography backwards so they could see it in a mirror, because it's okay to see porn on a mirror in Islam. And they were saying Islamic words and they were going to take the thing down. But then a marshal stopped them. The mainstream media is not reporting this. It's like, dude, you got sent a fake email. Yeah. This isn't real. But like, but at least back in the day, my God, the amount of constituents that literally thought if they received an email that it had the same quality control measures as the Washington Post was incredible. Of just kind of walking them through basic civic literacy and media literacy. That was disturbing.
It's crazy that Facebook went back in time and amplified that misinformation. That's crazy that social media did that. it's because that was invented when social media happened. Yeah, I think that there is certainly an element of, you know, a democracy is something that I think even, you know, a misty-eyed government appreciators or democratic republic appreciators like you and I can look at in this very glowing halcyon light. But I've also never had to take repeated phone calls with, you know, random people yelling and screaming at me, which would probably, you know, never meet your heroes, including democracy.
Yeah. Well, like, no, I mean, the upshot to it is, you know, I'm a limited government guy. I'm a free enterprise guy. I want a tiny, competent government. I want a big, big hillock of freedom in the middle.
Yeah.
And then I just kind of want like those bumper lanes you get at bowling alleys.
Yeah.
I want the government to do that. I want it to be on the edges, keeping people from falling off the rails. But I want just a big mess in the middle. Right. So as one of these guys that is inclined towards limited government, I have to say you're generally getting your bang for your buck with your congressman. Your congressman, despite how dumb you might think it is, he's probably a lot smarter than the average constituent. I've hung out with a lot of congressmen now. I've hung out with a lot. I'm not like I'm a constituent too. Sure. Just as we're all constituents, right? It's not like you're not automatically an idiot.
No,
but there's a very high idiot ratio. You're generally getting a higher IQ. And then I'll say your congressional staff, you get an excellent bang from your buck from them. Like I so this is in 2010. I want to say when I left, maybe 2011. Like I'm in my early to mid 20s, I was making $30,000 a year, $30,000. So this is 10 years ago, $30,000. It would not be sufficient for me at this time.
No.
But that's how much I was making. I wouldn't have been making significantly more if I'd been on the policy side of it. But you have some really dedicated people that are putting in a lot of time and effort and skill set, and I gain a lot of respect for that. As a shrink the government guy, I think we should be paying congressional staffs more.
And they actually just passed a thing about that. I think they just changed the rules about staff pay. So,
oh, interesting. Do you know how they did it? Because it used to just be like they'd give congressmen like a flat sum that they could allocate however they wanted.
You would have to look into it, but it was a thing that Pelosi like very recently just did.
Yeah.
Okay. So everybody's yelling, everybody's screaming. You have informed the your boss, the congressman, exactly what the will of the populace is, and did he take it or did he make his own move?
Yes. I think both things happened simultaneously. I do not remember. I think that the district was leaning against ACA, as I recall. I think it was broadly, it wasn't like a slam dunk. And this is years ago and I don't obviously have the numbers,
sure.
But I just based on feeling, I want to say it was like probably 70-30 in terms of that. And he voted with the district. He voted against it. I don't know. I think that this is probably a good example of a congressman operating based off of the actual will of the constituency. I did not have any in-depth conversations with him about ACA back in the day that I can remember. But I don't think he was an ideologue on the subject. I mean, he was very much a union guy. He wasn't fundamentally opposed to government interaction and things like that. But I think he represented the district. So I think he had a good idea. I will say, I think that congressmen rely far more heavily on the people that they meet than they do on the phone calls and emails, which are a lot more indirect.
Yeah.
So I think that if you're wanting to communicate with your congressman, you're going to have much more impact going to the pancake breakfast over at the Shriners Lodge or seeing them at the parade or something than you are calling their office, just because there's an availability bias that they're subject to like anybody else. And I suspect that on the ground back in Pennsylvania, That was probably his read of the situation.
And your message is going to have to get filtered through some gangly jamoke like Andrew Heaton. So, you know, you
got to figure that out.
Yeah. Give me a sense of
He's going to say snide things about you because of the dumb stuff you said about Gene Hackman at an obviously cockamamie email.
He's going to sit on it for 10 plus years before revealing your dumbass Gene Hackman take on the politics show. Give me a sense of the overall vibe in Congress. Was there like an us versus them on the votes? Like how much do you interact with other people's staffs? Are you just pretty much in your own orbit with your own spaceship?
It's far more collegial than you would think.
Yeah.
Now, granted, I came there prior to the Tea Party. I left right as the Tea Party was percolating.
Okay.
So the Tea Party was coming in to shout at us. But they hadn't had the opportunity to vote yet. And so I came in pre-Tea Party from an electoral standpoint. I am told by my friends that remained on the Hill that did have a kind of animus effect on the Hill to some extent. And I've certainly not been there during the Trump years, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if that had a chilling effect as well. But even then, I would bet that it's still a lot more collegial than the average American would assume. For two reasons. First of all, Washington's a lot more collegial than people assume.
Yeah.
In Washington, if you can't be convivial with people you disagree with, that is a professional liability for you. And unless you are, your whole life is in a very specific advocacy role within an echo chamber environment, you're not going to get very far in Washington. And a significant amount of the people on the Hill are going to go on to work in lobbying firms.
Yep.
We've incentivized that structure. Unless Ms. Pelosi fixed that, I wasn't going to stay there making $30,000 a year until I was 30.
Yeah.
And I certainly wanted to do it with a kid. So that happens, right? Well, you need to be able to make friends with other people. That's professionally going to happen. You also live in a city full of kind of extroverted, talky type people that like circulating at cocktail parties. When I was on the Hill, I had lots of friends that were bipartisan. I'm still friends with a bunch of them. I'm still friends with people from my softball team that I visit when I'm in Washington, D.C. Some of them were Democrats that I think were, for the most part, working for blue log offices like myself. A couple of them are still on the Hill now in the Senate. Some of them were Republicans. And it really didn't make it an issue. Now, granted, it may not have for me because me working for a blue dog, I was functionally in a moderate third party, in
a purple situation where you could. Yeah, I had to talk to both people. Yeah,
right. So, but even then, I don't think that it made a huge deal. Like I was next door to Joe when I worked for Dan. I was next door to Joe. I can't remember the guy who screamed, "You lie." During the State of the Union address, if you remember back in the day.
Yeah, hold on. Keep going. I'll figure it out.
So he's a Republican office and we're next door to the Republican office. And his boss yells, "You lie," during the State of the Union address. And so
Wilson,
I swung by.
Joe Wilson.
Oh, man. He would like for a week, whenever he left the office, he just pretended to be on the phone. So he wouldn't have to talk to anybody because everybody wanted to yell at him.
Oh my God.
But everybody wanted to yell at his staff. And so like I came in and I don't think I gave him a beer or anything, but I was just like, "Hey guys, like I know you're going through hell. Like find me at the bar. I'm going to buy you a pint." Cause I knew what they were going through. I'll say that generally speaking, and maybe this isn't true in certain states, but there's generally a camaraderie with the rest of your state delegation.
All the Pennsylvania people stick together, all the New York people stick together, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the Pennsylvania, like we were friends with people. I was friends with people in Pennsylvania offices that were both Republican and Democrat, and then in Oklahoma too. Like, I mean, granted, Dan is like if Dan Bourne had been born like 18 feet west, he would have been a Republican.
Yeah,
but. But like, you know, that it really wasn't a big deal. Like Dan he'd invite we got to meet a bunch of cool people through him, like Leon Panetta, who was then head of the CIA, and Antonin Scalia. And he would invite all the interns from the Oklahoma delegation to come meet. And then plus on top of that, like the other thing is you need to socially remember the staff are ages generally 22 to 28. That's probably most of the Hill staffers. There's people that are above that, but generally speaking, in terms of constituent liaisons like myself and just basic legislative assistants, the median age is probably 27. And then you do get chiefs of staff and LDs, legislative directors, who are career, who will be in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. But that's two people out of the entire office. Most of the office has been out of college less than 10 years and is in a town where they don't know a lot of people. is kind of horny and drunk a lot.
Gotcha.
Those are the people running your government. And that's fine during the day. We were fine. But at night, we all kind of want to blow the lid off of it and make out with that cute blonde from, you know, Wilson's office, whoever down the hall.
Yeah.
And in my case, because I have too much respect for the institution, I never made out inside of Congress. I did drink there a lot.
Sure.
But after hours,
After hours.
And if anybody thinks I'm a lush, everyone in Congress, I mean, Congress is just, it is piles of marble floating in a tub of bourbon. Every office on the Hill has at least two handles of bourbon in it at any given time. And you're thinking, not our guy, Mike Lee. Absolutely, yes. Your Mormon senator has an office full of bourbon. He's not drinking it. I guarantee you his staff is. So there's a lot of conviviality going on there. You're in the trenches. You're dealing with it. You're like, I was on an exchange serve with all the other staff assistants because we had like an economy going on.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, one of the duties of staff assistants is that it's your job to coordinate White House visits for constituents. The White House, at least while I was there, and I think that this is a done deal in perpetuity, doesn't want to ever reject people from coming to the White House. So it outsources it to congressmen. That way they have to deal with the negative side of turning you down. But as a result, congressmen get like, I don't know, 20 passes a month or something to go on a White House visit. So you might be in a situation where you're like, we really want to get this person and their family to be able to see the White House, but we're at all these passes. Does anybody have any spare passes? And they'll say, yeah, we've got spare passes. But, you know, can I have that? We'll pay you back later or whatever. So you end up getting to know them, but then you're on a chat room all day. You're in what I'm sure today is Discord or Slack.
Yeah.
And you're going, you know, God, I'm really hungover. Is anybody from Florida got any orange juice? Because all the districts,
they all have their own things. Yeah.
They get free party favors from their district. We had like peanuts or something stupid like that. But orange juice is great. So you get to know them because you swung by to get orange juice while you were hungover.
So even during a moment where there is like, you got to get the vote, or like there's a holdout vote or it's a close vote or something like that. Like even then everybody understands, hey, look, that's the front of the house, you know, here for us in the staff. We're all just trying to answer phone calls and get out of here whenever we can.
I think so. I mean, I'm sure that there no doubt there's going to be personality types that are attracted to working on the Hill because they are ideological firebrands. I didn't actually encounter that many of them. I'm sure they're there. And I'll say it even goes up. Like one of the things that I found surprising working on the Hill was how convivial the members of Congress are with each other that you wouldn't know about. Like, so I know you and I have talked about this in the past, but Inhofe and Barbara Boxer. Inhofe is a very conservative Republican from Oklahoma. Barbara Boxer is a very progressive senator from California. They're good friends.
Yeah.
Like to the point where like Inhofe would like bait her to come to Oklahoma to campaign for his opponent because he knew he would get a surge in the polls.
Yeah.
Like he knew that the best. But at the same time, they would literally like fight like cats and dogs in a Senate committee meeting. And then they go get dinner together.
Yeah.
And that was to me seemed to be a lot more normal. A lot of congressmen are they are kicking up more of a partisan dust storm than they actually mean.
Yeah.
And behind the doors, they've got more of a buddy element than you would anticipate.
Very, very, very informative. A behind the scenes look, at least at the framework of what is likely happening right now. Heaton, to pivot off of this subject, a lot of rumors largely being spread by me on this show that you might be moving. You might indeed be moving to Texas, indeed to Austin, Texas, where I live now. Can you confirm or deny this?
I will momentarily. Do you mind if I put in one more observation about Congress?
Nothing could be more on brand for you, of course.
Great. So having been inside of the institution, having spoken to several congressmen now post that experience, the most notable one being, Justin Amash, came on my program about 6 months ago, not to talk about libertarian boilerplate, mind you, but I just wanted to talk to him about that, about a Congress. I think what would benefit that institution more than anything else would be if committees elected their own committee chair. And I realize that sounds like a weird procedural side note, but here's why. You hear people saying just how expensive it is to run for Congress and how expensive it is to run for the Senate. It's not really. About 80% of the districts in America are completely safe. In 2020, we had a 7% federal turnover rate in elected offices. 93% of the offices that were up for grabs in 2020, I should say it's all elected offices. That includes county and state levels.
Yeah.
93% of them were retained by the party that went in with them. It's not a high turnover rate. Congressmen aren't worried about losing money. But in Congress, those committee chairs are passed out based on how much money they can raise for the party, which is why congressmen spend 20 to 30% of their time phone banking and shaking people down for contributions. It's not for their campaign. It's for the DNC and the GOP. And that
by the way, for folks now, if you are into this tracking stuff like this, watch for people from very safe seats, either in Congress or in the Senate, yeah, that are raising a gigantic amount of money, because it ain't so they can run ads saying vote for me, yeah, because doy. It's so they can kick it back into the party and get these influential spots.
And that is how they are rewarded. That is how our incentive structure in the United States Congress is not currently rewarding anybody for being convivial. Now, that happens somewhat on a personal level, but there's no incentive right now to do that, which is a whole nother talk about open primaries and ranked choice voting. But in terms of the actual just institution itself, it would be of tremendous value just to have committees appoint their own chair where everybody takes a vote, because that would remove that incentive. It would allow congressmen to actually focus on their job. And yes, I'm moving to Austin, Texas.
Hey, there we go. There we go.
This is breaking. I haven't even said this on my program. My own listeners don't know this yet.
That's why I have the journalism degree. I get you the situation. I get the goods.
I am so excited. To go back down to Austin, Justin. It's a fun city. You're there. Brian's there. I have other friends there. So I anticipate that being a really good social environment. I think it's going to be really creative because I'm going to get to collaborate with you and Brian more, which is going to be awesome.
Yep.
And I'm going to compensate for the heat by just going to Scotland 4 months a year during the summer. So I think this new plan of living in Austin 8 months on and Scotland 4 months on is a pretty good fit for me. I think I can make this work.
I think you're going to be A-okay. For the listeners here, I will say, you know, with all cheeky teasing aside, Heaton and I have not really talked about ways that we will collaborate regularly, but I can only suspect that it will be somewhere between where we are now and the amount of crossover that you saw during the November month when you were up in Oakland and we were doing all the stuff leading into the election. But I would suspect that you'd be able to regular Heaton and Justin content.
Absolutely. I just had on John McWhorter on the program this week. It took me 2 years to get that guy. I just drive over to your house. It's way easier to get you.
Easy.
So why would I do that?
I'm thrilled. I'm very, very excited that you're moving down. I'm very excited to work with you more on podcast stuff and anything else that pops into our dumb heads. So I'm super thrilled. Andrew Heaton, The Political Orphanage, of course. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that wraps it up for us today. Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you would like to congratulate Andrew Heaton for moving down to Austin, Texas, putting us both, for the first time ever, permanently in the same city, you can head on over to px3guest.com. You want to email the show, it's a very simple process. You just head on over to the email program of your choice and you dial in theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Our Twitter is at px3tweets. You can see our live streams at px3live.com. If you'd like to share this podcast with friends, family, clergy, local representation, you can do so by sending them the very simple and, dare I say, attractive URL of px3podcast.com. And especially because Christmas is coming up, Hanukkah's coming up, Kwanzaa's coming up, you want to get a gift for the politically inclined person in your life, politicsmerch.com. By the way, if you want to give us a one-time donation, just a little tipperoo to say thank you for doing this, you can do so at paypal.me/payjury. Our Venmo is Justin-Young-20. We got a bunch of people looking to see whether or not Venmo Cash is real. Here we go. Let's see. Where was the last one? Where was the last one? Oh, Venmo's not loading. Venmo's just not. Here we go. Here we go. Alec. Alec says, this is a real buck, or is it fantasy? Caught in a quandary, no escape from insanity. Open your mind, and bankers will find a way. It needs no bank fees, furnish no sympathy. Anyway, take it. I'm still glad you make the show. Here you go. And that was pretty much it. Thank you, Alec, for writing a Queen-inspired message there. That's real. That's a real Venmo dollar. Our Cash App is PX3 Cash. And by the way, you can always send anything physical to our P.O. Box. P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas. I got some political merch from James. James from Australia, and I guess James ran for office in Australia because he sent me a bunch of his own merch. I've got a ton of James merch as well as some dong. I got some dong, baby. I got 10,000 dong in my hand right now. Yep, the Vietnamese currency. He sent me a bunch of Vietnamese currency, as well as a shirt, as well as a magnet. Thank you, James. I don't know, based on your note, whether or not I'm presuming you did win or did not win. It's a 2009 shirt, and the dong that I was given was $4.50. So that's nice. I feel like that's a pretty good idea. Of course, if you want any of our bonus content, you can do so at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you two bonus podcasts each and every week, covering all the news that we miss on our regular show. And the $10 tier gets you that, plus your name read at the end of the program, including Idris Arslanian, DJ Katie Mack, Niemeister, Dr. G, Lord Scale, Dekinse Anile, Admiral Flapjack, Utah Jimmy Montana, Edmund Pluribus Unum, Pete Spicery, 70s TV Salesman, or Spy, D, Really, and Gloria Young for King of the New World Order, Zombie Doc, Edison, no mention on the podcast, please, .com Junkie, DP4 Bongo, Pop Gold, Jewish Lives Matter, 100 Mile Runner, Double K Ranch, Ye Olde Pinball Shop, John Snuffies off Route 44. Neil, Charles, Darren, Olin and Angela, DL, Steven, Chad, Miranda, Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, the most conscientious nonpartisan listeners, Brad, Richard, D Laser, just another pilot, middle aged Mike, the Gen, Will, J Pink, and Andrew. You want to get your name listed there? Friend, there's only one place you go. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That wraps it up for us today. The money man, Dave Leventhal, joins us on the program on Friday. And we're going to research some of the biggest props before Election Day. Oh, yeah. By the way, we're less than a week away from Election Day. I mean, it's kind of a boring Election Day, but still, it's an election day, and it's an important local election day, so familiarize yourself with the props that you're going to have to vote for, the proposition votes. Go ahead and look out for that on Friday. Till next time, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only program that dares broach
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.